Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're tuned to 90.5 WKAR here on an abbreviated holiday week. Everybody here at WKAR excited about the 4th. On today's program, we will update the oil spill that was discovered late last week in the Grand River near Old Town in Lansing. Julie Powers is executive director of the Mid-Michigan Environmental Action Council. There was a gathering yesterday to update everybody on the status of the spill. It is still a mystery at this point as to how that happened and who might be responsible. We will also talk with a state representative from West Michigan, who is getting an awful lot of attention for his efforts at rethinking prison reform here in Michigan. State Rep. Joe Hoveman joins us. Representative Hoveman heads the House Appropriations Committee, and as probably most of you know, corrections eats up a colossal percentage of state revenue. And he's taken this on as a cause of his own and is getting an awful lot of attention for focusing more on rehabilitation in Michigan prisons. We speak with State Rep. Joe Hoveman coming up in just a few minutes. On Friday, our nation celebrates its 238th birthday, but today, America is also observing the passage of one of the most significant laws ever crafted in its history. On July 2, 1964, President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That law forbids discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. It was born in an era of violence and intolerance in America. Just a year before, the Michigan Constitution of 1963 created a Civil Rights Commission, the first state ever to do so. Joining me to talk about Michigan's civil rights history and legacy, Leslie Fritz, the Deputy Director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights. Leslie, welcome back to Current State.
Thanks so much, Mark, for having me on. I appreciate it.
It's great to have you. We do hold a unique distinction in the arena of civil rights. We were the first state to create a civil rights commission by constitutional mandate. What did that law do to inspire your agency's mission?
Well, you're absolutely right, Mark. Michigan has a proud history of civil rights action and progressive action on in the area of civil rights. In 1963, we became the first state to say it's important enough to us to create a commission and give it the authority to enforce anti-discrimination laws. The Civil Rights Commission was born that year. We, as the Department of Civil Rights, are essentially the staff arm of that commission. And 50 years later, we keep working towards the mission that the Constitution laid out for us. We enforce those anti-discrimination laws, and we do our best to educate and help everybody who has to follow those laws to understand what they're required to do. Because an awful lot of what we deal with is misunderstanding, in addition to bad intentions. And so we do a lot of work at education and outreach to help people understand what the law says and what the law means.
And
how best to follow it.
And the year after the revised Michigan Constitution, we saw the landmark federal law. What did the federal law do to shape the early days of Michigan's agency?
Well, it really lays the groundwork. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, as you very accurately described in your introduction, was the first federal legislation to say anti-discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, national origin, and gender is no longer going to be allowed. I mean, most people think of it, and rightfully so, as an end to the Jim Crow segregation laws in the South. It was the end of sitting in the back of the bus. It was the end of whites-only lunch counters. But it really laid the groundwork for equality for all people, not just African Americans. It was the first law that said women have to be treated equally in the workplace. It laid the foundation for the Voting Rights Act that came the next year, the Fair Housing Act that came in 1968, the Americans with Disabilities Act that came a number of years later. So it really was the first and the foundational piece of legislation that creates equality for all of us in all walks of life, whether it's employment or housing or public accommodation, whatever the case may be. And that's the very business that the Michigan Department of Civil Rights is in. We have the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act here in Michigan, which says very much the same thing as the federal act. It actually goes further. creates protections for a number of categories that aren't included in that federal Civil Rights Act. But it's the very work that we do on a daily basis, ensuring that regardless of who you are, where you come from, what you look like, that you have an equal opportunity to get a job and have a place to live and to enjoy all that Michigan has to offer in the way of public accommodations.
Leslie Fritz is our guest. Leslie's deputy director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights here on the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1964. What was the civil rights climate like in Michigan in the mid-60s? I mean, did your agency have to win hearts and minds, or was the public, I think a lot of people assume the public was a lot more tolerant here in the North. How many hearts and minds did your agency have to win over?
Well, it's an ongoing effort, no question. You're right. The climate in the 1960s in the North was certainly less filled with violence than what people in the South were experiencing. We all remember those scenes of fire hoses and dogs and violent protests. That really was not occurring to that level across the North and here in Michigan. But public opinion was not on the side of integration and desegregation. I mean, if you look at Gallup polling, that was the most prominent public polling of the time. The people here in Michigan thought were nervous is probably the best way to describe it about what was happening across the country as it related to desegregation. Change is always hard. And certainly the 1960s was a decade full of change, big, big change. And people here in Michigan were not anxious to see it happen, were nervous about what it meant, and were not particularly supportive. Thankfully, the leadership at the time here in Michigan and across the country was willing to do things that were unpopular because they were right. You look at somebody like George Romney, who chaired the Constitutional Convention, went on to be governor. He was a huge advocate, a very vocal voice for civil rights at a time when it was not particularly popular. John Hanna, the president of Michigan State, chaired the United States Civil Rights Commission as the first chair after it was created. Martha Griffith, who most of us remember as lieutenant governor, was in Congress at the time. And was a very significant player in ensuring that women were included in the U.S. Civil Rights Act. So Michigan had very progressive leadership that was willing to stand in the face of unpopular stand in the face of popular opinion and do things that they believed were right, even if they weren't popular at the time.
Two big events happened in Michigan within just 3 years of each other that challenged your department. The first was the race riots in Detroit in July of 1967. How did your office respond to those?
The Civil Rights Commission was a very active player at that time. Governor George Romney was governor by then. He had appointed the first Civil Rights Commission, and those eight men and women were still serving their very first term when the race riots broke out. He called on the Civil Rights Commissioners to go to other communities, to Pontiac, to Saginaw, to Flint, to Ann Arbor, and to ensure that the violence did not spread. Those eight men and women were really the ambassadors for Governor Romney to other communities to bring leadership around the table, to talk to the ministerial leaders, the law enforcement, the elected leadership, to ensure that we did not see this kind of violence break out in other communities. And it really shaped a lot of the early work that the commission and the department did. Because it was just 2 years after we were formed that all of that was happening. And obviously it spoke to a need to address a number of issues, economic issues, housing issues, employment issues in communities across our state.
The second event was the murder of Burton Gordon, the first executive director of the Michigan Civil Rights Commission, whose murder in March of 1970 remains unsolved today. I want to mention that, but I have to ask you about today's civil rights frontiers. How does the Michigan Civil Rights Commission, how is it involved in today's civil rights issues?
Well, we continue to be, you're right. Let me speak to Burton Gordon before I answer your question. Our first executive director at the department was in fact murdered in the parking garage outside of our office in Detroit, and that remains unsolved. There's a number of people who believe that murder was the result of the work that he was doing. We won't know that until the murder is solved with certainty. But certainly the work of civil rights in the 1960s was dangerous work. And Burton Gordon is somebody who we remember at the department who sacrificed an awful lot and ultimately his life to bring equality to communities across this state. But the work that we do today is certainly built upon and influenced by all of that activity that was going on in the 1960s. We continue to be, to the best of our ability, the voice and advocate for people across the state who need to have an equal opportunity to access all that Michigan has to offer. It is no longer just about dealing with race relations, although certainly that's a part of what we do. Michigan is an incredibly diverse state. We have a very large community of Arab Americans, the largest outside of the Middle East. We have a large and growing Hispanic population, a large and growing Asian American population, all of whom are trying to assimilate into the Michigan that we remember from our childhood. So our communities are changing. And with that change comes challenge. Our school districts are dealing with it. Our communities, our neighborhoods, our law enforcement agencies are dealing with people from all over the world who come from different backgrounds, who practice different religions, and are trying to help ensure that our neighborhoods are safe and open, that our business community and our jobs are available to all people, and that our housing is available to anybody who needs it. So it continues to be the work that we do every day. It's just a little bit more diverse community that we're working in.
It is the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1964. Leslie Fritz has been our guest. Leslie's the Deputy Director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights. Thanks for joining us, Leslie.
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate it.
50 years ago today, President Lyndon Johnson used more than 100 pens to sign the Civil Rights Act in the presence of such luminaries as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy. Johnson offered these hopeful words.
We must not approach the observance and enforcement of this law in a vengeful spirit. Its purpose is not to punish. Its purpose is not to divide, but to end divisions, divisions which have lasted all too long. Its purpose is national, not regional. This Civil Rights Act is a challenge to all of us to go to work in our communities and our states, in our homes and in our hearts, to eliminate the last vestiges of injustice in our beloved country.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. Our next guest is getting statewide attention for rethinking prison reform here in Michigan. In a recent op-ed, Republican State Representative Joe Hoffman of Holland describes coming to Lansing 5 years ago to advance principles of limited government and restrained spending. He goes on to describe how his commitment to those principles unexpectedly led him to advocate reforms to Michigan's $2 billion a year correctional system. In particular, Representative Hoffman says Michigan needs to increase its focus on rehabilitation of people convicted of crimes. State Representative Joe Hoffman, welcome to Current State.
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I am great. Thanks for joining us. In this op-ed that appeared in last Sunday's Lansing State Journal, you wrote that you came to the Capitol 5 years ago to advance these principles, limited government, restrained government spending, but you say you were surprised to learn how those priorities are closely connected to prison reform. What did you learn that surprised you?
Well, Mark, I came in 5 years ago as a freshman in the minority with the hopes that we could get our hands around the prison spending. It had been through a number of years having the department come back to the Appropriations Committee and asking for supplementals because they overspent their budget. It had topped the $2 billion mark in spending. And people were starting to pay attention, saying, you know, that's just a huge amount of money, and what are we getting for it, for locking people up for these long periods of time, and then trying to figure out how to make them or expecting them to be better people when they came out, and finding that that wasn't the case. So that's where my heart was originally, is saying we need to just cut the spending on the corrections department. What I discovered is we've got to start reforming the way we think about corrections, the way we handle our prisoners and what we do with them, and who we lock up. So it's been a great journey, and I think the Corrections Department under this administration has done a fantastic job of starting down that road of rethinking the rehabilitation of our prisoners.
How do we need to change our thinking specifically?
Well, we can't just lock people up without concern for them, thinking that once they're locked up, we're safe somehow on the outside. We need to treat them like human beings yet, frankly, and we need to look at their mental health, their physical health, their well-being, because 95% of them are going to come back out and be our neighbors. And when they come back out, we want them better people than when they went in. And currently, we've got a long way to go on that.
How are your fellow Republicans responding to your efforts and this increased focus on rehabilitation?
Well, I think this is a Republican cause. The Republicans all over the country are starting to realize that simply locking people up and throwing away the key, a paradigm that's about a generation older or started a generation ago, has just led to more cost, more people locked up, more laws, and not less crime. If we were truly making our lives safer on the outside by locking everyone up and not worrying about them, I'd write the blank check to build more prisons. But that hasn't happened. We've seen less crime in our communities because of demographics. Our society is getting older. And because they're getting older, we have fewer young people committing crimes. When you visit our prisons, you notice that there's an awful lot of these kids that come in, and that's when they're entering prison, is when they're early 20s. That's the generation that we have to get to, both in our prisons and outside, to start curbing our crime. But we need to do a better – my goal is that we do a better job inside the prisons to rehabilitate these people, so when they come out, they can reenter society and not recommit crimes.
Republican State Representative Joe Hoffman of Holland is our guest here on Current State. We're talking prison reform, his efforts at rethinking prison reform here in Michigan. It appears some members of your caucus risk being viewed as not tough enough on crime if they shift their focus. Is that a concern for you?
That is a 10-year-old mentality that goes back to the early 90s, but it's out of date. And I tell my colleagues, I tell anybody, this paradigm has shifted. You got to quit worrying about looking like you're soft on crime. The mantra today is trying to be right on crime, smart on crime, and that, you know, just throwing away the key, just asking for stronger sentences, more years in prison for a crime, isn't going to make our streets safer. It isn't going to make those people that go into prison better when they come out. We need to rethink that. And I would hope that we look at diversion projects or methods like our mental health courts, like drug courts, like our veterans courts, and look at alternatives to incarceration. Because in a lot of ways, incarceration can make things worse, not better.
It sounds like you're still actively trying to change minds here, though.
Well, there's always going to be a variation of opinions.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm saying that the Republicans around the country, Republicans like Newt Gingrich and Rick Perry and John Kasich and Bill Bennett have signed on to this, saying, you know what, we can't just keep writing checks and using taxpayer money to lock people up and build more prisons. It hasn't worked. The system is broken, and we have to look at a new way of doing things.
You and many others spent the day yesterday at a gathering sponsored by the Michigan Law Revision Commission, MLRC, having the first of what you described in your op-ed as difficult, necessary conversations on how to improve Michigan's correction system. What kind of start did you get off to yesterday? What got discussed?
Well, we hired about a year and a half ago the Council of State Governments to come in, a think tank, to come back and look at our correction system and give us recommendations. Some of those recommendations were very technical in looking at the sentencing guideline grid and adjusting sentences a little bit, but staying within the existing grid. They didn't make many changes to that. Probation is one of the main topics that I think is getting some life on, that we look at intervening with people earlier in their criminal behavior, if you will, and use probation a little stronger so we keep people from going to prison later. We try and change their behavior before they end up in our correction system. That was an exciting conversation. There's a new program called Swift Ensure that started out of Hawaii that some counties are using, and we're excited about trying to see that expand. That would intervene with people very quickly, create a very short-term, immediate disciplinary action at the county level, and that would be, as I said, an immediate reaction, so people know that there are consequences for their behavior. That was some of the conversation. And
how difficult was the conversation? You anticipated a difficult, necessary conversation. Was it a difficult conversation?
Well, it certainly, we included prosecutors, defense attorneys, state appellate defender's office, and judges, and we know that there's going to be varying opinions. Prosecutors in general are reluctant to make any changes. They believe that any change could be perceived as lessening sentences. The discretion of judges and prosecutors is always a topic, and there was varying opinions as to whether tightening these sentencing guidelines takes too much discretion away from the judges. I think we can work through some of those issues. I'm not in favor. I've always been a strong advocate of allowing the judges to have discretion and looking at cases on an individual basis.
Did you get a
conversation about mitigating circumstances. And when a person comes before a judge, you not just look at the nature of the crime and the aggravating circumstances, but you look at the cause of the crime in terms of why did that person commit it. Those are mitigating circumstances, and I think that I agree with that concept. So we're going to hold this session at least a couple more times around the state, one in Grand Rapids, one in Traverse City, and it's a great conversation to have.
Was there any response from counties or county government people on the Swift Ensure idea?
Oh, yeah. Naturally, when you're talking to local governments and you're talking about potentially changing the way they do their services, funding is always an issue. And counties were not shy about saying, hey, if you're going to require this of us or encourage this of us, then certainly funding has to be part of the conversation. We understand that. And I respect that. I'm an old county commissioner. I know that they provide tremendous amount of services, and we'll have that conversation as part of this.
There is an ongoing, our guest is State Representative Joe Hoveman of Holland. He is the chair of the House Appropriations Committee. We're talking about corrections. There is an ongoing intense debate over what kind of role privatization plays and should play in Michigan's correctional system. What do you think?
Well, I was instrumental in my second term of trying to implement a competitive bidding process of looking at what services needed to be provided strictly by state employees and which items could we look at outside contractors to provide a competitive bid. I'm not as concerned about bringing companies in from the outside and privatizing as I am about making sure that we have a competitive atmosphere, that state employees, state unions not be complacent assuming that there's no competition out there. I think we were effective in that. We did put out a bid for a full standalone prison by an outside contractor, and the administration bid that out and decided that it wasn't worthwhile doing. And I'm okay with that. We went through the process and we looked at our cost, and it didn't make sense. So I think we will continue to push competition within our state employees, and this shouldn't just be for the Department of Corrections. We should be thinking in these terms throughout state government of how do we do things better for less taxpayer money.
Yesterday, Governor Snyder suggested the situation with Aramark, Michigan's prison food provider, has become troubled enough that the administration may consider terminating the contract. This follows dozens of cases of food poisoning in the Jackson prison last weekend and the discovery of maggots near food there. Should Aramark go?
I think it's too early to decide if Aramark should go, and the governor stopped short of saying that he's going to pull the plug on that. I think the department has been effective in trying to work with Aramark. That remains to be seen, and I have a meeting coming up with Aramark in the near future to discuss this. I don't know yet. It may be a case, where privatization or an outside contractor didn't work, but I'm not ready to just write them off and say that, okay, we have to go back to the old system. Perhaps we just picked the wrong contractor, too.
It certainly makes it harder, though, to promote the notion of competitive bidding in state government contracts. Would you concede that?
Well, Mark, let's be clear. Whenever a private contractor comes in to work for us, the unions are right there to fly-spec every problem they have. When the state employees and the unions themselves are doing this work, there is not someone reporting back to the news media every time there's a problem. And I just to say that this was a problem since Aramark came in, I don't think it's fair. So problems exist with our system, both in corrections and throughout the state, even with our own employees. Now, they're just, frankly, they're not as documented as well. And we don't have you and other news media there paying attention to it. So I don't think it's fair just to say that since this happened with Aramark, the wheels have come off. That's not it at all. We have some difficulties. We have issues. And I think the administration is dealing with them rightly.
Great conversation. We want to thank our guest, Republican State Representative Joe Hoveman of Holland, chairs the House Appropriations Committee. We've been discussing prison reform in Michigan. Representative Hoveman, thank you and good luck.
Thank you, Mark.
Last Thursday, an oil spill was discovered in the Grand River near Old Town in Lansing. As crews continue to clean it up, city officials are planning their next moves. Yesterday, Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero held a news conference to give an update on the spill. Environmental groups say this is not the first time oil is spilled into the Grand River in Lansing. Joining us to talk about the situation is Julie Powers. Julie's the executive director of the Mid-Michigan Environmental Action Council, and she attended yesterday's news conference with the mayor and other officials. Julie, welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having me.
What do we know about how and when the spill occurred last week, and what did we learn yesterday?
Sure. Well, what we know is that a week ago today, around 6 o'clock, there two things happened. According to the press conference, we learned that there were two 911 calls placed reporting a sheen on the river. Around the same time, a DEQ employee was down doing routine monitoring and noticed the sheen as well and notified the DEQ of the spill. So we had it happening parallel. So it went through law enforcement as well as through the DEQ. Within about half an hour, the fire department was deployed, and they don't have the they don't have a boom, an absorbent boom. So they called in the Board of Water and Light. They have a cooperative agreement. And the Board of Water and Light put in what's called an absorbent boom, which is different from a rigid boom. They put in an absorbent boom to try and contain it. I made it down there about 8:45. I got an anonymous tip on our Facebook page, on the Mid-Michigan Environmental Action Council page. And I didn't see it. I was at a class. And so by the time I got down there, it was a couple hours after it had happened. And I have to tell you, I mean, I've been down there for a lot of spills. I've been down there for a lot of reports of sheen on the river. And this was the worst I've seen. The smell was overwhelming.
How much oil was spilled?
We heard yesterday that it was about 5 gallons. The challenge is knowing. When stuff's spilled into the water, it always looks like it's more than it is. I mean, you'd think that there were, you know, hundreds of gallons just from looking at it, because it's hard to imagine what it looks like and with the disbursement into the river. We don't know for sure, though, because we don't know what made it through the storm drain and into the river before the report happened.
Whose estimate is the 5 gallons?
That was what we got from the fire department and law enforcement yesterday at the press conference.
Yeah, but you would assume it was greater than that?
Possibly, sure, yes. We know what the company, Schultz is the company, they're a hazardous waste or a non-hazardous waste removal company. They do septic systems, and they were brought in with a tanker truck to suck out this from the river. And so, you know, but in addition, they're sucking out river water. So, you know, by the time you separate the two, you know, we're never going to know exactly to the ounce how much was spilled into the river. We can only give broad estimates.
Hmm. Well, any oil in the river is a bad thing. But if it was only 5 gallons, is this, this is generating a pretty significant response. But is that in part due to a repeated pattern of oil spills?
I obviously can't speak for law enforcement. I can tell you that from the environmental perspective, we're concerned because this is clearly a pattern. 4 times in the last year. The first time I got called down there for a large oil spill was a year ago, 4th of July weekend. I actually ended up having to come home early from my vacation because of an oil spill down there. Reports, and they had booms in the water and stuff. But there have been 4 pretty big size ones. And then there have been anecdotal reports, but not police reports, from folks who fish down there of other incidents of sheen, more than what would happen after a rain. So this is an ongoing problem. But from an environmental perspective, every drop of pollutant that ends up in our river ultimately ends up in our drinking water and in our rain and in our crops and in our grass. And I mean, this is a huge issue long term for our watershed. I mean, rivers aren't supposed to handle your old used motor oil. That's why we separated our storm sewers and our with the sewer separation project. And also, we have proper disposal methods for used oil and gas and other hazardous and toxic materials. So the concern is somebody is doing something illegal. I mean, this is illegal dumping.
Have the previous incidents, do we know what happened there?
No. What we were told every time is that they were unable to trace the source of this. We know that it's coming out through the drain that empties just above the Brenke Fish Ladder. And you can go down there and see the drain. I mean, if you walk down to the Brenke Fish Ladder in Old Town and just walk up the path a little bit, you can actually walk, you can crawl down the bank to the river and stand on top of the storm drain outflow into the river. If you trace that back, in the Public Service Department yesterday gave out maps of the system, and you can see where all the storm drains inflow to that. So they went back 16 blocks in the last week to see if they could figure out where the source of it was. The problem is we've had 2 major rains, one over the weekend and then one this week. We had some big storms come through, mm-hmm. and it washes away a lot of the evidence. So you can't definitively prove that it was dumped at X location unless when it happens you can get out there without a rain and you can get out there immediately, because there's going to be splash. There's going to be some evidence of where this was dumped.
Do you think this is one party?
Absolutely.
Now, why do you think?
Because
that?
I don't think at the same time, magically, 20 people accidentally kicked over a can of motor oil after changing their car oil in their driveways.
So you think we're trying to track down one person, company, whatever,
entity. Yes. I have no idea if it's an individual, but yeah, this is one bad actor. Now, could it be several individuals? It happens, doing this. Sure. And I'm really pleased to see that this is a criminal investigation because I people need to know illegal dumping into our storm drain, that is a criminal act.
Your group writes on its Facebook page that the city lacks, quote, a coordinated disaster response plan for rivers and waterways. Who is not coordinated with whom, in your opinion? Have you looked at it that closely?
We have. The real challenge here is that we have different entities that have responsibility for different parts of the river, the water. We have DEQ, we have DNR, we have the EPA as the oversight. We have the city, and then depending on where you are, it's the drain commissioner. And then in other places, it's Board of Water and Light. And the environmental groups are on the fringes sort of yelling about it. Now, you know, who monitor? Oh, and the health department's in there, too, because the health department monitors parts of the river for E. coli and other pollutants and contaminants. Michigan State University monitors their section of the river. And I'm just speaking specifically about the greater Lansing area at this point. And this happens in every part of the state. It is a complex maze, and there is not a lot of coordination. We don't have a disaster plan. And the thing that wakes me up in the middle of the night, if I have a nightmare, I don't have nightmares about falling through space or anything like that, like most people. My living nightmare is we will have an Enbridge in Lansing, and we don't have a plan for dealing with it. It's stuff like this, and this is why I yell all the time about why we have to protect our water, and we have to work together. We have to have a plan. We have to be ready. Because if something like that, like Enbridge happened here with a million gallons of oil, we don't have a plan for dealing with it. We waited 6 days to declare this a criminal investigation when we know this has been going on for at least a year, possibly longer.
What are your next steps now?
I'm going to be talking to public service before the end of the week to come up with at least a response plan on our end. Several years ago, we went out and we stenciled
The City of Lansing?
City of Lansing, yeah. Okay. Working with the City of Lansing Public Service Department. Several years ago, we went out and stenciled many of the storm drains. When the sewer separation project was new, people didn't know what to do with storm drains because we'd always had combined sewer and stormwater. Now that they're separated, We have some education to do. We need to do a fair amount of – we need to educate people. This drains directly to the river. We need more community education, and that's where we're going to take the lead on educating people that all of those storm drains drain directly into the river, and it is our responsibility as citizens and residents of the City of Lansing or surrounding municipalities that you don't dump into those. And if you see somebody doing it, you need to let the police know.
Were you encouraged after yesterday's gathering, or do you see too much chaos here?
You know, I think there's still some chaos, and I think time will tell. I'm hoping that once everybody sort of returns from the 4th of July weekend, that we can get together and have a pretty serious conversation about what we would do in the event of something larger than 5 gallons. We need to have an emergency response plan that includes scenario planning. Mm-hmm. We need to practice.
Julie Powers is the executive director of the Mid-Michigan Environmental Action Council. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR being Wednesday, it's time for our Neighbors in Action segment when we feature people and organizations working to make the greater Lansing community a better place. Today we feature the Mayor's Young Lansing Coalition and Partnerships, or My Lansing CAP. The coalition, which was officially announced last week, features a broad array of community partners and stakeholders that are coming together to improve the quality of life for Lansing's young people of color. Here to tell us more about My Lansing CAP are three people who helped make this all happen. Angela Waters Austin is the director of One Love Global. Hi, Angela.
Hi there, Mark.
Delisa Fontaine is a lead organizer with Nurturing Early On is Necessary, or NEON. Hi, Lisa.
Hello.
Delisa, I beg your pardon. And Tim Lloyd is a lead organizer for Save Our Sons. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you.
Angela, the official announcement of My Lansing CAP as it's being called, was last week, but this has been something in the works for some time. Tell us how this all came together.
Well, as you know, Mark, the community has been focusing on improving outcomes for children of color for the better part of the past decade. I came into it about 8 years ago, and working with policy groups, working with families, working with youth, but all really focused on the same issue. And what the mayor did so beautifully was follow in the footsteps of President Obama and use his office as a platform to bring all of this wonderful energy together.
Delisa, how did you get involved, and why is this important?
Well, I came along when we began the LISA project under the Kellogg grant through Lansing Early Childhood Equity Program. me and some fellow community organizers created a organization, grassroots organization called NEON, Nurturing Early On Is Necessary. And we are Lansing families partnering with organizations to engage and build relationships and knock down barriers to empower families of color to take greater control over the conditions in which we are raising our children ages 0 to 8.
And your organization started a Tri-Unity initiative. What is that?
Tri-Unity is an initiative that focuses on early childhood literacy. So Tri-Unity, Tri being community, schools, and churches, faith-based initiative, to where we are trying to raise the, we're trying to close the reading gap between young children of color and their counterparts by 30% within 3 years in three red districts. So we have Tri-Unity, three.
We go. Okay, very good. Tim, you're a lead organizer for Save Our Sons. Tell us about your organization. What do you do?
I'm the organizer for Saving Our Sons. It's to address black male achievement. We wanted to bring awareness to the city collectively to address systemic problems that have plagued African American men and boys. We want to put it on a large scale and really start dealing with some of the things that have plagued us for so long, eradicate a lot of the barriers, hidden barriers that are out there, and dispel some of the myths with African-American men.
What would you put on your short list of goals? What particular problems would you really like to address?
I think one of the biggest problems is our school-to-prison pipeline. We have to address that urgently and really quickly.
And any thoughts on how that gets done?
Well, our educational system has to be in place. I think we have to bring information to our educational system, and they have to understand some of the problems that have plagued African-American boys in particular. At an early age, you hear and you read about the suspension rate for African-American boys, sometimes 2 to 3 times higher than their counterparts. The expulsion rate is just out of the roof. So some of those things we have to address in our school system.
Our guests on Current State are three key members of a new organization, My Lansing CAP, that stands for the Mayor's Young Lansing Coalition and Partnerships, officially announced last week. It's a broad array of community stakeholders coming together to improve the quality of life for Lansing's young people of color. You had an event at Sexton High School this past Saturday, Tim. How did that go?
It was magnificent. It was an event for the entire community. We hosted an event to really showcase African American men to address some of the issues, because there's a lot of myths out there, and I think it starts there. I think we have to dispel some of the myths about African-American men in particular. A lot of the myths are they don't like to father their children, or they're absent in the homes and stuff, and that's not the case in every home. And so addressing some of those issues, also pointing out some of the issues that have plagued African-American men, some of the self-afflicting things that we need to address, and also the bigger picture, the systemic issues that are going on and have gone on for some time.
Angela, tell us more about the coalition. As I've said, you've got a broad array of partners on board. Tell us about some of the other groups, their roles.
A number of organizations have been doing the work, and it was really just a matter of bringing in some of the bigger institutional partners, as well as the grassroots, the faith, as well as our youth and family organizations. So the partners include MSU, where we're sitting right now, Lansing Community College, the Lansing School District, Ingham Great Start Collaborative, because we are looking at children from ages 0 to 25. So what we're doing is bringing together organizations, institutions, agencies, grassroots, formal, informal, from the neighborhood clubs to the car clubs and motorcycle clubs, all the way to institutions like MSU that really are committed to seeing things change. And there's a role for everyone in this movement.
Sounds like a lot of work coordinating all of this, though. Delisa Fontaine with NEON, Nurturing Early On is Necessary. This has all been really grassroots, and you've been speaking with parents and youth in the community, asking for their input. What concerns, what particular concerns have you heard about the most?
Okay, well, so from from families, we've heard that, first of all, we had to toss out all assumptions. We went into this, you know, as normal people, we thought, we're going to hear this, and we're going to hear this, and that's what we're going to focus on. But when we began to talk to families, and so far we've spoken to almost 300 families in total in the Lansing area, and the main focus is jobs, education, and safety. Those are the three issues they want to focus on. Families want to work. They want to get back to work. And, you know, this was kind of surprising because we thought, you know, the economy's on an uptick. We didn't think that was going to be a major focus. But, of course, everybody wants to provide for their family. They want a better education for their children. They want after-school programs. They want neighborhood programs. They want tutoring and such for their kids because they want their kids to achieve more. And then, of course, safety. And when you think of safety, we thought of, you know, big things such as violence and stuff. They said, no, we want our streets fixed. Mm-hmm. We want our kids to be able to go out and play without falling into a huge pothole. So a lot of assumptions had to be tossed out in order for us to learn.
You talked to a lot of young people, though. All of you have. Mm-hmm. What kinds of things have you heard from them?
From the young people, we went again with our assumptions, and what they told us is three major key elements, and that's what we are focusing on in Tri-Unity and Saving Our Sons. Love, persistence, and mentorship. They want to know that we love them regardless whether they're doing great, whether they're doing not so great, whether they are kind of acting up, whether they're being knuckleheads. They want to know that we love them consistently. They want us to be persistent. We may not get them on the first time. We may not get them on the fifth time. We may not reach them until it's our ninth time talking to them, but they want to know that we're there and that we're going to be consistent and persistent. And then they want mentorship. They want someone to guide them. They want someone to help them maneuver their way through their teenage years on into young adult years.
Tim Lloyd of Save Our Sons, you've had a lot of contact with fathers here, which is a main thrust. But have you talked to the sons as well? And what kind of messages are you getting from them?
Absolutely. They're echoing just what Delisa just said. I mean, they want the consistency out of our men. They need the consistency out of our community. And so SOS, you know, Saving Our Sons, it's a collaborative effort. It's for the entire city to get behind. It's a all-inclusive initiative that we want everyone, Hispanic, our whites, our Asian, everyone. It's because this is what's important, I believe. I think that when one portion of our society is affected in areas, I think we all should rally behind that, because if that particular portion of society is affected, it's going to affect us all. So it's a collective type of initiative that we need the entire community to rally behind.
Angela, what's it like now that the mayor's officially on board? What does that do to your movement here?
Well, we're here in your studio. So first and foremost,
you got our attention.
Absolutely. Yes. It elevated the work to a platform where we're able to engage in these conversations and get more people involved, raise awareness about the issue, and that it is an economic development issue for our region.
Where does your funding come from?
We have moved to this point through a grant from the Kellogg Foundation to a partnership, which Delisa mentioned, the Lansing Early Childhood Equity Partnership. That grant has come to an end, and we are now heavily moving into fundraising, and that is the nature and the beauty of the partnership with the mayor's office, is that he's able to ask his wonderful friends to invest in this initiative.
And the mayor's report says you hope to raise up to $2.7 million a year?
And that's just the beginning. If we're really talking about transforming our systems to improve outcomes for children from birth through age 25, $2.7 million is a drop in the bucket. But I want to say that there are things that we can do without any money. We can change the way that we think and the way that we practice.
Right.
We can keep kids in school. There's no reason that 91% of the boys being children being expelled in preschool are black boys. That's something that we can do without a dime.
Delisa Fontaine, what's your biggest challenge at NEON?
Not having enough time to do everything that we want to do. Because so many things catch our attention. Like when we first started off, we were just focusing on just engagement with families, connecting organizations with families, being a bridge. And then it grew into our Tri-Unity campaign. And then it massively grew into our SOS campaign, Saving Our Sons. So just time and time to get everything done. We also need more volunteers, parent volunteers. They can always sign up at neonlansing.org. They can receive information about our events. They can volunteer, create volunteer opportunities in their neighborhood, all type of things.
Tim Lloyd, what's next for Saving Our Sons?
On July 26th at the Fahrenheit Lounge in Lansing, I think at 1 p.m., we will be meeting with a lot of community people from the event, and we will be discussing some of the events that we're going to do further in the neighborhood. Some of the things that we are liking to do is we've targeted like 10 neighborhoods that we want to bring SOS to their neighborhoods and see how we can change some of the situations that are going on in the neighborhood. So.
Okay. Angela Waters Austin is director of One Love Global. Delisa Fontaine is lead organizer with Nurturing Early On as Necessary, or NEON. Tim Lloyd, who you've just heard from, is lead organizer for Saving Our Sons. Thanks to all of you for joining us today. Good luck.
Thanks for having us.
We could always use more nominations, and we know there are people and organizations out there doing excellent work, but we just don't know about them. Please help us out. Tweet us our suggestions at KAR Current State or send us an email, currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line. Tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work that they do. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State. We'll be back tomorrow. Have a great day. Current State on 90.5. WKAR.